Molt bona tarda a tothom. Benvinguts a aquesta nova edició dels debats d'educació. Els que us heu apropat novament a aquest auditori i també a totes aquelles persones que en aquests moments ens esteu seguint a través del vídeo streaming. Per començar, com sempre, hem d'agrair al Museu d'Art Contemporani de Barcelona la seva col·laboració ja sostinguda en aquest projecte que ens permet gaudir d'aquest magnífic auditori i també doncs, ens facilita l'enregistrament de l'acte. Debats d'educació, com la majoria de vosaltres sabeu, és una iniciativa de la Fundació Jaume Bofill i també dels Estudis de Psicologia i Ciències de l'Educació de la Universitat Oberta de Catalunya, amb una trajectòria de ara ja més de 10 anys d'activitat ininterrompuda. Debats d'Educació té el propòsit de continuar avançant, mantenint la que va ser la seva intenció inicial, que és la de proporcionar un espai per al debat, obert a la participació i a la sensibilització dels principals actors socials i singularment a la comunitat educativa, entesa en el seu sentit més ample. Pretenem abordar temes d'actualitat, però també qüestions de fons que ha d'afrontar l'educació en una conjuntura que ningú se li escapa, doncs, per nosaltres és complexa en aquest moment, i fent però sempre un esforç d'elevar la mirada per poder identificar els desafiaments que haurà de fer front l'educació en el futur. Sens dubte, el tema que ens toca avui és un d'ells. Amb aquesta ambició, el passat mes d'octubre vam posar en marxa una nova iniciativa que completa d'alguna manera el projecte Debats d'Educació. Em refereixo a un seminari web que tal vegada alguns de vosaltres potser heu tingut l'ocasió de participar. Aquest seminari web, a partir d'ara, alguns dies després de cadascun dels debats que encetem en aquest auditori, ens oferirà un nou escenari per la reflexió que ens ha de permetre eixamplar les oportunitats de participació i a la vegada ha de garantir noves vies per poder ampliar la base de reflexió al voltant de les aportacions dels nostres ponents convidats. Així doncs, el primer seminari web ha partit del darrer debat que vam mantenir el mes de juliol amb la Valérie Hanon entorn de la problemàtica de la desafecció escolar i la construcció de comunitats educatives capaces de fer-hi front. El seminari el condueix en Joan Badia, col·laborador habitual dels debats d'educació i jo diria que un molt bon coneixedor de la complexitat del nostre sistema educatiu. I bé, no podria desaprofitar l'oportunitat per agrair-li també doncs, al Joan la destresa amb què condueix el seminari. En cada ocasió estarà acompanyat d'altres persones properes a la temàtica que tractem i en aquesta primera edició al seminari doncs hi van haver convidats en Jaume Funes, la Begoña Gasc, en Joan Rué, aquí també hem d'agrair la seva participació i les aportacions que han fet en el seminari que us he de dir doncs, que estan a la vostra disposició si voleu recuperar-les, accedint al nou contingut que anirà posant a l'abast aquest nou seminari web a través de la pròpia pàgina dels debats d'educació. Més enllà, de fet, de l'aportació inicial dels convidats, el seminari web s'obre també a la participació amb el propòsit d'incorporar la discussió al major nombre d'òptiques alternatives i en aquest sentit doncs hem de dir que jo crec que estem molt contents del nivell de participació que hi ha hagut en aquest primer seminari a la xarxa. A veure, us animem doncs, a inscriure-us-hi perquè d'aquesta manera us podrem tenir al corrent de la informació rellevant sobre les properes edicions. I accedireu molt fàcilment en aquest espai perquè a la pàgina principal de la web dels debats, en una de les pestanyes superiors, hi trobareu l'accés directe doncs, en aquest seminari. Això una mica doncs, per posar de manifest doncs, que, com us deia, doncs, aquest projecte continua endavant amb l'ambició de continuar eixamplant les oportunitats de participació i de col·laboració de tots plegats. No? De fet, la idea de les oportunitats que obre la iniciativa a què m'estic referint en aquest moment, les opcions que ens ofereix per la participació, la col·laboració i l'aprenentatge compartit, traient partit de la potencialitat que ens ofereix la xarxa, em permet enllaçar directament amb la qüestió que voldríem tractar avui. Em refereixo concretament a la capacitat que poden tenir les xarxes d'aprenentatge en línia de transformar l'educació. És una magnífica oportunitat per nosaltres poder abordar aquesta qüestió de la mà d'en Philip Smith, que és el nostre convidat d'avui, i aquí doncs, voldria agrair-li sincerament que hagi accedit doncs, a apropar-se fins a Barcelona per ajudar-nos a pensar en aquesta qüestió. Però no seré jo qui el presentarà, serà en Baltasar Méndez, responsable de la Fundació Jaume Bofill, que us presentarà el ponent i també us farà una introducció a les qüestions més rellevants que li hem plantejat. Després obrirem el debat, com sempre, perquè ens interessa molt que els que sou a la sala hi pugueu dir la vostra.
Val. Moltes gràcies, Maria. Doncs moltes gràcies als que esteu aquí a la sala per haver vingut. Volem que aquest debat realment sigui viu. Si tenim l'oportunitat de tenir un superexpert de l'MIT aquí amb nosaltres, aleshores volem la vostra participació. També volem fer una invitació especial per la gent que està a casa o a la feina seguint-nos via streaming. Teniu la possibilitat de participar a través del canal del Twitter. Podeu enviar les vostres preguntes, intentarem des de la taula contestar. I sense res més, engeguem el debat. L'objectiu, com comentava el Josep Maria, és intentar parlar d'aquestes noves maneres d'aprendre de la mà del Philip Smith. Ell ha treballat amb qüestions relevants relacionades amb l'experimentació en l'àmbit educatiu, l'aprenentatge entre iguals. Volem saber què és això de l'aprenentatge social, val? Si esteu d'acord amb això o no, també estaria bé saber de vosaltres què opineu. I, sobretot, en Philip, la seva gran especialitat són els continguts oberts. O sigui, té una gran trajectòria a la democratització de la informació, a l'aprenentatge obert. A més, jo crec que la seva participació avui ens donarà la possibilitat de conèixer una mica l'òptica d'una institució de referència com pot ser l'MIT Media Lab. Com sabeu, és l'Institut Tecnològic de Massachusetts, que és una de les institucions que ara mateix més estan innovant en el tema també educatiu. Doncs, volem debatre amb vosaltres, amb el Philip, sobre la manera com es construeixen aquestes comunitats d'aprenentatge online, realment funcionen, quin impacte tenen aquestes comunitats en el món de l'educació que us toca de prop, vosaltres que esteu al peu de l'aula, vosaltres que esteu al món de l'acadèmia estudiant, què vol dir això d'aprendre i com podem aprendre millor. Realment preguntarem al Philip i entre tots intentarem veure com fem això. O sigui, realment, totes aquestes eines, aquesta innovació que en Philip ens explicarà avui, impacta, sí o no, i com? I si realment podem fer de l'aprenentatge una situació inclusiva de qualitat. O sigui, que no sigui només per les elites. Mal? El Philip, veureu que una de les seves preocupacions sempre ha estat en aquest contingut obert. I ha treballat en projectes arreu del món, amb la UNESCO, etc., per intentar fer una educació inclusiva i de qualitat. Doncs, a part d'aquests temes, com heu vist a la invitació, si heu llegit la convocatòria, comentàvem que intentarem preguntar amb el Philip sobre algunes iniciatives de l'MIT, com pot ser el MIT Learning, Creative Learning, que és una comunitat on volen reimaginar el tema educatiu avui. Val? Això intentarem preguntar. També el Philip està molt a prop d'una iniciativa de l'MIT, que és l'Scratch, que crec que molts de vosaltres coneixeu. Volem saber una mica, almenys que ens fa 5 cèntims de què vol dir això. Ara mateix són 7 milions d'usuaris, una aplicació que va néixer allà i que està impactant directament a l'aula. Volem veure com, què és això. I també volem que ens expliqui una mica, sé que li estic posant la feina molt difícil, perquè són moltes les peticions i el pobre ha estat contestant e-mails sense parar perquè som una mica pesats a vegades amb això. Però és que creiem que hi ha una oportunitat de conèixer de prop aquesta experiència. Una d'elles és un projecte que és el Peer-to-Peer University. Ells han creat, de la mà d'en Philip, una escola d'educació dins d'aquesta universitat entre iguals. Val? Volem saber què és això d'una universitat entre iguals i si funciona o no funciona. Val? I, finalment, passo la paraula, val? Com sabeu, al Philip. Ell és el Director Fellows de l'MIT Media Lab, fundador d'iniciatives com aquesta, la Universitat Peer-to-Peer, d'altres com la Learning Creative Learning. També ha estat un dels impulsors del Open Courseware, que és aquesta plataforma de cursos gratuïts online. Ara mateix són 13.000 cursos que tenen online. I treballa directament amb persones, amb els líders del Creative Commons, del Lifelong Kindergarten, etc. No diré més perquè és un llarg currículum i com és un home que té la seva vida professional molt oberta, podeu buscar ara mateix en el Google i trobareu tot el seu currículum. Val? Doncs gràcies i donem la paraula al Philip.
The floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, first of all, good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for already won too fast. Thank you very much for, first of all, having me here. I have very fond memories of Barcelona. We had one of the first peer-to-peer university workshops in Barcelona at the same time when the Mozilla Festival was held just upstairs here. I don't know if anyone went to that Mozilla Festival. But it was kind of the early days of open education. It was very exciting. And so I always associate Barcelona to some degree with the one of the projects that I've spent a lot of time working on. And then I also want to thank you for letting me speak in English, because I noticed when you were speaking Catalan, there were only three people with headphones in the audience. So now you're all indulging me to speak in the language that I prefer. And so thank you very much for letting me do that. So as Valentinia said, I am based at the MIT Media Lab and I run an initiative called Learning Over Education. And it's a somewhat controversial title. And so I want to get it out of the way before people start interpreting it in the way it's not intended. My mother was a teacher and I'm a huge fan of educators and of teachers. But sometimes today, education can feel like it's something that's being done to you, and learning is really at its core something you do for yourself. And so we're trying to shift the conversation a little bit in the direction of learning as we're thinking about the impact of new technologies. I want to ask one question before I jump to the first slide. How many of you remember when Netscape 1.0 was released in 1994? Yeah. Okay, so it's a few hands, maybe a quarter of the audience. And it's important to remind ourselves sometimes. So you are, we are kind of the last, we're clinging onto the digital natives, right? Like we just made it into a world where much of our adult life, we've had the internet in some form or other, so we could imagine its effect. But what's amazing is now, if you go and speak at other venues, everyone in the audience will not remember the time before the internet. And for us to be kind of at this cusp where we remember the past and the institutions of the past, and also we can start imagining the future, it's a really interesting space, I think. And it's hard to keep up with the ones, like my students, for example, who cannot remember not having the ability to type questions into Google or going to Wikipedia. Their entire lives have been digital. And they take a lot of things for granted that you or I may be skeptical about or a little nervous about, or we may not be so happy about. But there is kind of this wave that's coming. And I think it's important that all of us who have been thinking about these things get involved. And so here's how how I got involved. When the internet kind of started, you know, it's kind of scary that, so Netscape came out almost 20 years ago, which means I've been doing this for a very long time, which worries me a little bit. But as I got interested in these communities like Wikipedia and open source software, where people would collaborate with each other online, I started realizing that there was something interesting that was shifting. And that is that talent is distributed equally across the world. There are as many smart and motivated people in sub-Saharan Africa as there are in North America or Europe, but opportunity is not. And so for many years, my personal interest in this space has been to change this, to increase opportunities. And the two tools that I like to use are technology and learning. I think learning is a good path towards a better future, and I think technology can make learning more accessible and create that path for more people. And just as background, this is the kind of real-time Wikipedia editing, not right now because I recorded this, but this is kind of what happens in Wikipedia at any moment. And so in order to do this, one of the things I did was I co-founded an organization called Peer-to-Peer University, which had a little bit of a crazy idea, and that idea was that if you were interested in any topic and you would find other people interested in the same topic, you could connect with each other online and learn it, and you didn't have to wait for an expert to teach it to you. You didn't have to go to a university and enroll in a degree program. In this new world, you could just go out and learn anything you wanted. And I'm still as excited by this possibility, but also I've been doing this for long enough that I've realized it's not that easy. So the organization Peer-to-Peer University has kind of evolved over many years and now spends a lot of its time co-designing learning communities, which is the topic of the talk today and the conversation. And so with this background, if you ask someone to speak about the core question, are open social learning communities the future of education, then of course my answer is going to be yes, because that's what I've been doing for 10 years and maybe longer. And I'm going to try to explain why I believe this in the next 35 or 40 minutes. And there are interesting pieces in this question, right? So I want to talk a little bit about learning and education, because I think there is a difference there, and I think it's important as we think about the impact of technology that we have a clear understanding of what we want to achieve through learning. And the answers may be very different for all of us, but I think often we jump into the conversation before we stop and we think about what do we really want to achieve with learning, what do we think is the role of the university. And then secondly, there are lots of predictions about the future, often technology, but some other ideas as well. And so I want to talk a little bit about what that means and what other people are saying about the future. And then I want to spend some time talking about examples for social learning communities online that are coming out of my work at the MIT Media Lab that we are involved in and that we're learning through. And so if we talk about the future, I think it might make sense to also talk about the past a little bit. So where does this come from? The origins of the University of Bologna go back to 1088, which is almost 1,000 years now with the rounding error. And that's a really incredibly long time if you think about companies that were around then that are still around. They're really only very few. They're generally either breweries or restaurants or hotels. There's a great list on Wikipedia, but for the university to have been around for such a long time is an incredible both achievement, but also it says that it plays a very important role in our society and has played through all these dramatic changes over 1,000 years. And what's maybe even more surprising is that some parts of it still look very similar. So this is a painting about the University of Bologna in the 14th century. And kind of like here, you have someone who thinks he's an expert standing on the stage reading from a book. So we don't need books anymore because everyone has phones and everyone can have books. But at the time, books content was a big problem. And then you have a bunch of students who are, you know, listening or talking to each other. And at least one student is also sitting in the corner and sleeping. And you don't know if he's just bored by the talk or maybe his football club won last night and he went out and he drank too many Moritz and he's a little hungover. But, right, so this is kind of what learning in the 14th century looked like. And in a way, the past, right, these 600, 700 years, it's kind of also the present still of education. A lot of education still looks that way. And also when we think about education, our mind immediately goes to that image, right? So when we try to imagine education, we immediately go to this image of sitting passively, listening, trying to stay awake. You know, it's really hard. And so this is, I think, a good moment to ask ourselves, what is the difference between education and learning? And are the two the same sometimes, or how are they related? Because we often use them interchangeably, and yet we know a lot more about learning today than we did in the 14th century. So here's an interesting slide that comes out of the work of my colleague Ross Picard at the MIT Media Lab. She put a wristband on one of her students and made him wear it for 1 week, and he had to record in a diary what he was doing at the different times in the week. And so some things are... Actually, they told me there's a little... Yeah. So some things are not surprising, right? Like, you know, when the student is studying, you know, there's a lot of... Oh, I should explain. The graph shows electrodermal activity, which is the current that you can detect on your skin, and it's an indicator for engagement. It can be physical engagement, physical activity, or it can be mental activity. And so it's a rough indicator for engagement. And so sometimes, you know, some times of the week, you would expect that when the student is studying and working on problems that, you know, they're engaged. When you look at sleep, you would expect it to look like this, where you fall asleep, your REM goes up, and then maybe you have a few slow wave sleep phases throughout. And when they work in the lab, right, and they're applying their work, they should be very engaged. Now, what's a little disconcerting is that of all those activities that the student did during the week, their engagement, I'm glad that wasn't mine, their engagement that is the lowest when they're sitting in class, right? So it's lower than when they're sleeping, obviously. It's also lower, at least in some cases, when they're watching TV. It's lower than when they're relaxing. And... You may say, well, you know, it's just MIT, so they have really bad professors there. And I think, you know, that would be a good, a valid hypothesis. But I think that probably this is true for many students in many universities. And we happen to know now that we have these devices and we know a lot more about how learning works, that lectures are actually a terrible way to learn. And it's going to be really difficult for all of you to listen to me for 35 or 40 minutes without falling asleep or letting your mind wander. And so I have full empathy for that. But when we're thinking about the future of learning and the future of education, we kind of want to know, you know, if lectures are not how students learn, then how do they learn? And so I decided to ask some people who are supposedly experts, which are the students. And I looked at some of the research, and there's a huge body of research, a lot of it coming out of the Open University of Catalonia. But also it's useful sometimes to just ask people very simple questions. And so I interviewed people from a whole range of backgrounds at MIT, students, people who had graduated, people who had dropped out and never graduated, administrators, professors, admissions officers, and I asked them about the learning experience at MIT. And the students, I asked, what was something in your MIT history that you would say was a really important learning experience? What was something that happened at MIT that changed the course of your life, or where you learned a skill that you're still applying today, or where you had a new idea that just blew your mind and afterwards you chose a different career, for example. And so I want to tell us one of the stories. I heard many, many stories, many amazing stories. I heard almost no stories about lectures, not surprisingly. But I heard many amazing stories about the experiences, and I think those stories exist at every university. I don't think that they are unique to MIT. The stories are different everywhere, but if you ask your students about the real learning that happens, a lot of surprising things will come out. And so here's one of the stories that really surprised me and delighted me in a way. If you look at this building, this is the dome of MIT. It's one of the most famous buildings on the campus. And as you can see here, people love to take pictures of it. You know, it's a grand building. And also, this is where the graduation ceremony happens. So every year when the students graduate, there are hundreds of students here, and there are speeches. And it's very so this is a very important building at MIT. And one morning in 2006, MIT woke up and it looked at the dome and there was a fire truck on top of the dome. And I mean, you saw the picture before. This is a very high building and this is a very big fire truck. And it definitely wasn't there on September 10th, 2006. And so how I found out about the story is I spoke to the person who was responsible for this. And she graduated from MIT and went on to get a PhD in science and then went on to become a successful scientist, managing a team of other scientists. And when I asked her about what was the most important learning experience, she said, without a doubt, the experience where I learned the most and that I'm most proud of in my entire academic history is putting the fire truck on top of the MIT dome. And so that's surprising. You know, if MIT is a very expensive university, if you had to pay for it, you know, you can pay $200,000 for your degree. And putting the fire truck on top of the dome is not included in the $200,000, by the way. but then, you know, I asked her about the process, and I realized it's not so surprising that she singled this out, because this was a six-month project where she managed a team of 40 engineers and scientists, and they had to prepare for an operation that would happen in one night to get this. There was no room for error. They had to get this whole thing on top of the dome, get it installed, make sure it's safe, it doesn't fall down. And they left instructions for how to take it apart as well so that other people can safely take it apart and take it down, which I think is really great. So, you know, in a way, if you think about great learning, a lot of the aspects of good learning experiences, you can find them in this example. And I'll just show you one more. And I should say there's a history of these projects at MIT, and they're called hacks. At MIT, hacking is not hacking with computers. It's finding kind of playful solutions and to systems. And so I really love this one. It's where students built a Tetris game onto the windows of the highest building on the campus. And then you could stand downstairs at the control and you could play Tetris on the building. But this is an aside. But coming back to this idea of learning, right, in this example of putting the fire truck on top of the building, there are a lot of components that or aspects that you could pick out and you would say, that's a great learning experience. And that's what we've been doing at the Media Lab. We've been trying to articulate a framework for learning that we implement every day at the Media Lab. So this is a picture of the MIT Media Lab where I work. And most of it looks like this. It's double story. It's different research groups doing very different things. There are 26 different research groups who work on totally unrelated things. We have 150 students and about 150 researchers and faculty. It's an interesting place because it brings together very diverse backgrounds and people who are all very passionate about what they do. But so this framework of learning is something that we practice and we observe every day at the Media Lab in the way we work with our students. But it's also something we've been thinking about as a way to design technologies for learning, to design workshops for learning, to design institutions, new institutions for learning. What are our design principles for this? And so we've come up with four principles, and we call them the four P's of creative learning. And you will find these, maybe we'll do this together, they relate to the fire truck. So the first P is P for projects, because when you build something or you create something, and creating can be a poem or a novel, it doesn't have to be an engineering project, a lot of the things that you had assumed before, theoretically, turn out to be not true. You run into a lot of difficulties, and there's a lot of learning that happens when you actually create the project. So you could learn about poetry for many years, but when you write poetry, it's a very different activity. There are certain aspects of poetry that you can learn from doing it that you wouldn't be able to learn from just reading about it. And so a lot of work at the Media Lab is engineering and technology. So, you know, we have a lot of projects that look like this. And the nice thing about projects is also you can show them to other people. So you can say, hey, I've done this thing, right? I don't have to do a test. Look at my solar car, it drives. Or look at my poem, it's beautiful. And then you can share it with other people. And that's actually the second P, is peers. And so a lot of the work at the Media Lab works in collaborative groups. And one of the reasons in the interviews I heard one person say, well, everything is peer learning because nobody is smart enough to get through MIT by themselves. And I think in some institutions that's true. At Harvard, for example, they did a study about success of Harvard students because they were interested in what makes Harvard students do well and what makes other Harvard students not succeed. And at Harvard and MIT, this is a real concern because, on one hand, it's extremely expensive. So for a student to come in, spend a year or two spending a lot of money and then dropping out, it's both a financial disaster for them, it's a human disaster for them because they feel like they failed. So finding ways to support them is really important. Harvard did a big study where they asked all of their students questions about what they're doing and how they're succeeding. It's called the Harvard Assessment Study. And the number one indicator for success was the ability to join or form study groups. So it wasn't how many courses you were taking. It wasn't if you were taking big courses or small courses. It wasn't all the other things you would have expected to hear. The number one most important thing was, can you find other people that help you and that you can help them when they need help? Because the nice thing about peer learning is also, even when you're trying to learn something, the moment someone asks you a question and you explain it to them, it turns out you actually learn the things in a much deeper way. And I think probably everyone has experienced this. If you get asked a question about something that you think you know very well, and it's a surprising question, it changes your whole, you kind of have to go back and check that you really understand this thing. So the third P is passion. And passion is essentially means that if you are really interested in something, if it connects to your personal interests, you will work much harder and you will go much deeper than if I'm telling you that you should learn something. So we try to enable all of our students to find things that they are passionate about, pick technologies that they are excited about, choose projects that they think can change the world, and find that those things that really grabs their attention, and then we try to support them. But finding ways to attach learning to the things that people are already interested in, I think, is really important, rather than the other way around, where first you have to learn all of the background about everything, and then you're allowed to start doing things. So passion is really important. And then the last one is play. And play and passion are easy to misunderstand. So for some people, I'll go back to passion. For some people, call it purpose. If passion sounds too hippie or too soft, think about this as purpose, right? Like there should be a purpose to your learning. And play, by play, we don't mean playing around, but we mean taking risks, experimenting, not being afraid to fail, right? Like the idea was that in kindergarten we play, and at least until very recently, you couldn't fail at kindergarten. And actually, ironically, the director of the Media Lab, Joey Ito, he he's a college dropout. He never finished his college degree, and he got kicked out of kindergarten. So we used to have this great example where we would say you couldn't fail at kindergarten until Joey took over the Media Lab, and now we realized you can get kicked out of kindergarten. But generally, right, learning should be an experience where you are taking risks because, and this is actually another quote from Joey, he says, no one has ever won the Nobel Prize for following the rules. And it's true. If you just follow the rules, you know, you can learn a lot and you can be very successful, but for really learning to happen, you have to feel that you're allowed to break the rules. And so I'll come back to all of these things, and actually I didn't do this, but the fire truck example, you will find all of these four P's very strongly represented in that experience. So let me say a couple of words about future. And future, the future of education is a big topic right now. If you Google future of education, there will be, probably there's another event about the future of education right now somewhere else in the world. And everyone has an opinion on it. And often those opinions are related to technology, right? So there's a new technology and people go, oh, new technology, the future of education, everything is going to change and everyone will have access, it'll be cheaper, more efficient, it'll be better. And most times that doesn't happen. There are some technologies where it does happen. The book, for example, is a technology that fundamentally changed a lot of things. But many technologies, just some examples in the last 100 years, radio, television, massive open online courses, haven't fundamentally changed the way things are because they've been used to perpetuate the old models. When a new technology comes, the easiest thing to do is you take the new technology, but you apply it to what you already know. So many of the new kind of set of courses, you know, they kind of look like 14th century Bologna, except that, you know, we have a bunch of experts in this case and they don't have a book, but they come through a video. You know, but it's still kind of one directional, the video, and then you have a bunch of students and they're watching the video, right? They're still listening passively. And actually, this is a much bigger problem now because, first of all, we can't see them anymore when they're sleeping. And there are many, many more who are dropping out, right? Who are trying to take these online courses and they're not succeeding. And yet we don't know why they're not succeeding. We don't know that they're not succeeding. It's really hard to learn something about the people who are not benefiting. So I'm a huge fan of technology, but technology, it's not the problem or the opportunity is not the technology, it's how it's being applied. And I briefly want to mention kind of the core technology that I think all of my work evolves around and which I think is a paradigm-changing technology, kind of like the book was, and that's the internet. And this is a beautiful illustration of the internet that's in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And the interesting thing about the internet is that a lot of design principles were baked into the architecture of the internet that are perfect for learning. So the internet as a designed network was open. Anyone could connect to it. All you needed was a cable and a computer, and you could connect into the internet. It's gotten a little more complicated these days, but fundamentally on a technology level, that's still the case. It lets anyone contribute, right? So it doesn't matter which of those nodes you are. It's not like radio or TV, where there's one big player in the middle, and they push all the content out to everyone. It's really everyone can speak and listen at the same time. And there's a peer-to-peer ethos that you can see in the architecture of the technology that then permeates the communities that people build on the internet that is very different from a top-down model where you're waiting for permission. You don't have to wait for permission on the internet. And then for people who are curious, I assume many of you are, it's just the ultimate discovery playground. You could spend your entire life just being on the internet, finding new people to talk to, finding new content, new ideas, doing new things. So the one thing that I think we often do when we think about what this is, we think of this as computers, right? So there are millions of computers, and they're connected by cables. But what I think of when I see this is the people in front of the computers. And that's when I think the technology becomes a paradigm changer. If it's just about connecting computers, it's less interesting. If it's about connecting millions of people who could be learning with each other, I think this changes almost everything. And I just want to say one more thing about technology design, using the Media Lab as my my thinking aid. So this is a picture of the Media Lab from the outside. And it has three principles for success in everything that it does. And we build a lot of technology. And those three principles are uniqueness. So if someone else is doing this already, we try to do something else. It's impact. So it's not enough to just have an idea. It has to change the world or someone's life in some way. It could be many people. It could be a few people in a really deep, meaningful way. And then the last one is my favorite one. It's magic. And those are the three official success criteria of the Media Lab. And people often ask me or ask magic. How do you define magic? And it's a little bit like learning, or at least some aspects of learning, like curiosity. It's like you can't really define it in a rubric or in a table, but when you experience it, you know it's happening. So, you know, when we see something that's magical, we're all enchanted. It puts a smile on our face. When we have a new idea, an epiphany, we know what that feeling feels like. We know that we can never go back. And so there's something that we can't measure yet today that is really important about technology and about learning. And my personal opinion is we shouldn't even try to measure it right now, because sometimes it can be dangerous. So summing up, technology can be the opportunity, can be the problem, but it's really about how you use it. Another one that I'll just briefly mention, and also because my two examples come back to this, is educators. So I think teachers and educators are absolutely crucial for the future of education. Now, I don't think they're the only solution. And I think there are some problems. As I said, my mom was a teacher, and I actually was a student once in her class. So I think she was very strict with me, but I thought she was a pretty good teacher. And, you know, I've had some very good teachers in my life, but I've also had a lot of teachers who were kind of okay, and I've also had a few teachers who were really terrible. And so I don't want to put all of my faith into teachers. I think that's too much. But teachers are, at least in the U.S., totally underappreciated, and there's a lot of room for improvement building the future of education, just helping teachers. So I want to give two examples for communities. They both use technology, and I'll talk a little bit about how we designed them and how you would design for online social learning communities. So the first one is learning creative learning. It's not your usual online course, and it came about when I first started working at the Media Lab. This has been my main collaborator, Mitchell Resnick, and I'll talk about him in a little more in a second. But Mitch and I, the MOOCs, a lot of people were talking about MOOCs, massive open online courses, and there was a lot of excitement about MOOCs, and Mitch and I were not so interested in MOOCs, or not so, we felt like they were doing some things really well, like making content available to many people, and producing more content. We thought those were good things, but there were aspects of learning that we really cared about that we didn't see represented in MOOCs, and so in true Media Lab style, instead of writing a critical article about MOOCs, we decided we were going to tinker with very large online courses. I'd done a lot of work with smaller online courses. He'd done a lot of work teaching at the Media Lab. And so we brought those two aspects together, and we decided, well, how does this happen? How does this work if you scale it up? And so we scaled it up to 25,000 people. So we had a fairly large community of people signing up. And we used the Media Lab, the formal course that exists at the Media Lab, as kind of our backbone, as our starting point. And then we made changes to that, because some things don't work online and some things you have to change a little bit. And one of the things that's very different when you think about an online community compared to a course, your role changes, right? In a course, you are much more in control. You define a lot more about what happens for each individual student. Each week, you test things. There's kind of generally a more rigid structure. At the Media Lab, it's a little bit different. But once you have a community the size of 25,000 people and you want creative learning to happen, there's no way you could even try this. So your role becomes much more the role of a host. So you're hosting a large party, essentially, right? You get to decide what music is going to be played, at least initially, until someone comes and they take away the remote control. Maybe you can prepare some snacks or some topics that people can talk about. You may have some ideas about who should be sitting with whom, where you think they have things in common. But then, you know, 25,000 people show up and you have to be comfortable to let go. You have to create ways for those people to start changing what happens and making this an experience that they want to have. And then you become more of a, you can model certain behaviors, you can set certain examples. But there's a way of kind of co-creating that has to happen. And so we did this very intentionally. We invited everyone who showed up to create this course with us. We said, we don't know how to do this for 25,000 people. We would love to get you involved. And not just tell us how to do it, but feel free to do it yourself. And so this is an interesting picture to me because it looks very common. It's a map of the people in the course, right? Every online course has these maps. But we didn't come up with the idea and we didn't make the map. So in the first week, Adriano Paracciani from Italy, he sent a message on the discussion forum. He said, I would love to have a map. Can you please make a map for the course? And everyone can put their pin in it. And we wrote back and we said, that's a really fantastic idea, but we don't want to make the map. We want you to make the map. And so Adriano made the map. He created it in Google Maps. He wrote a little how-to. He became the steward of the map. People asked him questions. My pin has disappeared. And these are by far not all the people, but there are, in Google Maps, there was a limitation where I think after a few hundred people, you had to make another map. And so there are dozens of maps. And Adriano really became the map guy. And he's still involved 2 years later. There's a community now. He's famous in the community. And that was how he started. And it was an idea that also is particularly important for community, which we realized later, because seeing the visual representation of the other people who are somewhere with you actually creates a much stronger sense of community than having an abstract list of names, right? So if you have 1,000 names in a long list, it doesn't feel very personal. But if you can see the pin on a map, at least, you can start imagining there's a person there, and it creates a stronger sense of community. And so we've tried to do that in all aspects of the course. We created activities every week that would let the people explore the things they were interested in. So we wanted them to feel like they were in control of this course, and we were giving them some activities, and then they could do those with other people, their families, or people they wanted to work with. And then every week there was a very strong aspect of sharing back what they had done. And a lot of the activities were offline. So the first one, this is the Marshmallow Challenge, which if you don't know the Marshmallow Challenge, I highly recommend you Google it and you do it. It's really amazing. It's an amazing learning experience. And I won't give away... There are some groups of people who are really good at it, and there are some groups of people who are really bad at it. Management consultants are really bad at it. and some weeks we did online activities. Scratch was mentioned before. It's a programming environment for kids, but you can use it to create stories, to create games, to create greeting cards. And also, it's the kind of environment where if you're a very advanced programmer, you can use it to do very complex things. And if you're a beginner, you can do it to do very simple things. And so we designed activities that we thought would let the community feel engaged in the course rather than recipients of knowledge. One other thing we did was live events, which was very unusual. So every week we ran a live event. We did a seminar, we had conversations, we had a big group of people show up in a chat, and we even did breakout rooms. So we wanted people to talk to each other. We wanted them to feel like they're part of, they're all these people showing up at the same time. And there's something really qualitatively different when you come to the space online or offline at the same time each week. And there's a sense of community that develops. People would recognize each other. They would always introduce themselves in the beginning. Hey, I'm from Rome. I'm from Barcelona. And it was just nice to see the people come together in that way. And we created a discussion forum. We gave them some other tools that are more obvious. And we let people create lots of other groups. So in the end, there were 450 individual discussion groups run by people from the community about things that they were interested in. We hadn't pre-created all of those. We couldn't imagine what all those things would be that they were interested in, but we totally supported it and we thought it was great. And some of them were offline, right? So not everything happened online. You don't have to have an online course that's just online. I think an online course that has offline components brings a whole different quality to a lot of the learning. Can I check the time? Because my timer is a little off.
24 past 7. 7:24.
Okay, so 10 minutes? Okay, perfect. And I would have said perfect even if it wasn't. But So learning creative learning, which started as a more of a course, really grew into a community. And we've run it twice as a course, so with kind of a start and end date. But all the materials are always available. You don't have to show up at a certain time to get to the materials or to join the discussion forum. But we found that people find it helpful if they can sign up for something and they can do it with other people. And so we've just launched a new model where we're hoping that the community itself will start running the course. So when 1,000 people sign up, we put them into a cohort and we kick off a round of emails where it kind of suggests certain things that they could do each week alongside with all the other people who are already there. And so far, I'd say mixed successes. The first week was really good. The second week was very slow. And we're already thinking about, could we have more language-specific communities or country-specific communities? Because it's really important that there are some people involved who feel passionately about the subject, but also who want to invest in building community. And we can't do that for the whole world. Like we're hoping that other people will come in with us. And we've written a report, Mitchell, I mentioned him before, Natalie Rusk and myself, about this experience at reports.p2pu.org. It's everything is open access, of course. So if you want to, it's a very friendly report. It's not very academic, but it summarizes some of those design ideas and decisions. And so my second example that I want to talk about a little bit for online social learning communities is called EdCamp. And when learning creative learning is not your typical online course, then EdCamp is not your typical conference. It's an unconference for educators run by educators. And there have been over 550 EdCamps by now in dozens of countries. I've just checked today, there hasn't been one in Spain. So I think that would be maybe a nice project for someone who's interested in getting involved in this space. It's a really great community around the world of educators who organize these events where other educators can come and they talk about the things that they're interested in. And so I mentioned there are unconferences, and I should probably say one word about what is an unconference. Well, maybe who knows what an unconference is or a bar camp? Okay, so just a few arms. So essentially, an unconference is a conference that's run by the participants. So generally, you set a date or a time. Everyone shows up at that moment. And the first session is that anyone who wants to host a workshop or host a presentation or host a panel can raise their hand, get on stage, and they can say, oh, what have we got here? For example, I can't read any of these, but what is that, enterprise micro something? So if I'm the expert or I'm really interested or I have a problem with this micro enterprise something topic, I get up on stage, I say, I really want to talk about this topic. I can present a little bit about my work, but I want to have a discussion. And then, you know, a few people raise their hand to indicate that they may be interested. And then you use kind of a time grid and a room grid and you create the conference on the fly. And people have been doing this for many years in different formats, and they work really, really well. People generally feel more engaged, feel more excited. It's much easier to be at an unconference than to be at a conference where you're generally sitting a lot, listening. At an unconference, you get to talk, you get to ask questions, you're in smaller groups. So it's a really great model, and it works very well in the physical world. It doesn't really work so well in the online world yet, at least it didn't. And so we set out to change that, talked to EdCamp and said, would you be interested in trying to do an EdCamp online? And they said, yeah, that would be great because not everyone can come to these events. And we would like to experiment with this online. And so we built a tool. I don't know if this will play, but we built a tool called UnHangout that leverages Google Hangouts. And most of this is actually pretty straightforward. There's a live video at the top where you can, you know, you can have presenters speaking or you can embed videos. There's a chat room where people can chat in the lobby. There's a list of people that you can see who's there. You can see their names. And then the interesting thing really is this. There's an unlimited number of breakout groups. So while the event is happening, we can create more breakout groups and we can, you know, we can give them names and we can use the feedback from the community to create those groups, right? So if the community says, I really want to have a breakout group on the color red, we create a breakout room for the color red. And then there's someone who wants to talk about blue, we make one for blue, purple. You know, we can spin them up while the event is happening. And because we're using Google Hangout for all the hard work, there's it's really easy for us to do because the in terms of technology, none of the heavy load ends up on our system. And so this is a picture of the actual EdCamp online. And this is Kristen Swanson, who's one of the founders of EdCamp and who is just a terrific educator and innovator. And she's giving a kind of an introduction. You can see these are some of the sessions. Educator Professional Development 1, Educator Professional Development 2, 20% of your time, which I think is the topic is can you create kind of an innovation culture in schools where teachers can spend 20% of their time working on projects that they're interested in. But all of these were suggested by the people, so there were 117 people, by those people who showed up for the event. And then they would break into these rooms, and you can see here, so we had 117 people and one cat. I don't know if you can see the cat on the screen. But and then people have conversations about the topics that, that they're most interested in. And so what are some of the benefits of these virtual EdCamps? Because EdCamps in the face-to-face world work really well. What does the online add to it? Well, it adds distribution. So two online events we've done so far and 15 face-to-face events have been a result of this. So people would come to the online event, they would get a sense of what this community feels like, and then they would say, I'm going to do a face-to-face EdCamp in my community where maybe nobody has done an EdCamp yet. Professional development for teachers. I don't know exactly what the situation is in Spain, but in the US, teachers have to continuously get professional certification. So while they're teachers, they have to go to workshops, they have to take classes. And a lot of it is very kind of, let's say, traditional, right? So it's not always super high quality. It's not always about the latest topics. Some of it is kind of lagging behind a little bit, whereas EdCamps are kind of at the cutting edge of what teachers want to do in the classroom today. Like, here's an experiment I did with my class. I want to share it with you. And so, not surprisingly, 86% of the respondents said that this was a good alternative to traditional professional development. Recruitment, 48% of the event had never been to an EdCamp. So for EdCamp, this is a great way of pulling in new people and growing their community. And engagement, 55% of the people created or voted on a session. So if you compare this to a normal conference where usually, right, you see the program, you arrive in the morning, and then you go to the each session that you're interested in. But you don't. Maybe you get to raise your hand and ask a question. But that's really the extent to how engaged people generally are. Here, in this event, 55% of the people took an active role. Either they said, I want to go to this session, this should happen, or they created a session. So it's a different kind of engagement. And surprisingly, you know, some of these things work really well online, and maybe sometimes better than offline. So are open social learning communities the future of education? I think so. I hope I've made a little bit of a case why I think so. I want to connect two ideas that I mentioned before because I think that's very important. One is I talked about peer learning and how in the Harvard assessment study they found that the ability to join study groups or form new study groups was the most important factor for being a successful Harvard student. Now, if you forget about Harvard, which is a few thousand students, and you think of the internet with millions, hundreds of millions of people, then the power that that skill gives you becomes much larger. So if you are a learner who's able to go out into the internet, find other people that you can learn with that help you, that is a huge advantage over someone who does not have that skill. So this kind of becoming a better learner, developing 21st century skills, is now not only is a very good thing, but also is a very important thing for everyone to develop. And then I want to end on this quote, which I think is great. When we talked about the future of education today, Alan Kay said, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And so I am trying to invent a future that is built around social learning communities online, but that should not be the only future. And I think all of you are inventors in some form, and many of you will be interested in education and learning. And so I hope that you will predict the future of education by inventing it with me. So thank you very much for all your time, and hope we can have a discussion.